another segment of the Grassy Knoll. This is a pre-record. We have with us the Informer, which will probably be our last segment. So we've agreed to kind of do a review, if you will. And I guess I'm looking back at a lot of the questions that I've gotten from folks since the series started and trying to hit them as best I can. And, of course, anything else that I-Man wants to address. But here he is again, and it's been a great time, I think, and I hope he feels the same way. And thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thanks. I've been starting to enjoy it a little bit.
Just when you're ready to go.
Right. Yeah, it was a little interpretation is when I started because, you know, people not believing. They have their own beliefs, and when they're hit with stuff that I've got and researched, they kind of look down on it and say, no, that can't be. And but I think they're getting some education at least. Whether it sticks, I don't know. But if they have any questions, like you said, that they had a lot of questions. But, you know, if they really went to the ATG Press, mm-hmm. and looked in there and looked at all the writings that I did, that will answer a lot of their questions. It's just that they have to dig for it and look for it, which I know a lot of people are lazy. They don't like to do it. But if you sat down and just read everything and absorbed it, it would probably take you a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, people do have time. The question is, how do they want to spend it?
Right.
Slogging through probably what is most daunting language is that of the legal / government combine.
Right.
And it's true. I mean, in fact, I'm going to open up with a question about this also. Can I do that at this time?
Sure.
You know, remember we went back and forth about meaning, one of the meanings of the term character.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I couldn't find it in the 1828 Webster's, and you said you did find it.
Right.
Now, I want you to understand something also, and this is kind of disappointing to me, that 1828 Webster's is online.
Oh, well, I've got the hard copy. That's where I went to look at it. So they apparently didn't put it in there.
No, and that, like I said, is disappointing because obviously it isn't the same as what you had in your hands.
Right.
And I got to think about that now. So, unfortunately, I guess what's out there is not necessarily an exact lift of that particular edition.
Well, yeah, I would say because the one that I have, I got quite a few years ago by the original fella that did it, and they did a reproduction of it, and it's you know, a regular 8x11,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to get my ruler right now and measure it.
I would have taken your word for it, but
it's 2 3/4 inches thick, so that's
yeah.
a lot of writing. So when they transposed this or copied it or whatever they did to put it into the online stuff, I can see where they miss or could miss a lot by mistake, or then it could be that they just didn't want certain things put in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, and this gets to where I want to go, because you've been in this a long time. And so, and let me ask you, do you have an email group, apparently, between James Montgomery? Can you count how many other folks that are of the like mind that you kind of keep abreast of?
5.
Okay, okay.
I mean, that's not much. When you take, there's 280 million people, but out of that 280 million, there's only 192 million that are taxpayers. That's recorded as taxpayers. The rest are kids and older people that don't pay taxes anymore.
Okay.
But if you take, that's less than, way less than 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take 5 people, it's like trying to find a piece of sand on the beach from the moon.
Okay. I'm getting back to the terminology, the legalese, or even some of, I would say, more of the esoteric uses of language that is quite common to
right.
law.
Right.
It almost gets to the point of being, and call it what it is, so esoteric, it's almost like a secret society's language and science unto itself.
Yeah, it is. And the only way that you're going to be able to know whether you're talking legalese or not, well, naturally, it's legalese if you're in a law dictionary or looking at a contract or anything like that or looking at a statute. You automatically look and say, well, that's legalese, you know. But then the people say, well, these are words. Well, no. There are words and there are terms. And the only key when you're looking at a statute, if they use words, they use common everyday words, but they also, when they want that word to mean something else, they make it a term. That is specific. It can't deviate. It can't be included. And nothing like the old argument is, oh, well, includes and including, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the word term, and I say word term, but if you look at terms, there can be no expansion or contraction of the term. It is what it says it is, and nothing can be included. So then if you look at the Internal Revenue Code, and you'll see that starts out in all the definitions, which are the key element, the term, yada, yada, yada. The first two words means the term, you know automatically, it is not a common everyday word, even though it looks like it. It is specific to what the law writer wants it to mean.
But that, of course, is never shared with the general public.
No.
And as you said, I mean, it gets to the point where, you know, I mean, we always talk about contracts,
mm-hmm.
and even your insurance, policy.
Insurance is all maritime. I don't care whether it's house insurance, whether it's car insurance, whether it's life insurance. It's all maritime, and it's couched in maritime terms.
Well, it's interesting also because it's said beyond belief. What happened in that Gulf Coast and what could happen here, and that is the insurance companies, defaulting on paying people.
Right.
That's amazing.
Oh, sure.
You know, and they walk.
Yeah.
So.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, getting past the obfuscation, if you will, with regarding to, and we'll go back to the legal situation if we could.
Sure.
But we talk about there are two, well, there's the United States and there's an America, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Not going in so much in depth, and again, let me ask you this. Can people apprise themselves of this whole situation by going to the website?
Yeah, if they know how to do the research, right? A lot of people, they do research and they, you know, they say, well, they're a researcher. Well, there's different levels of researchers. To be a real researcher like I was in major industry, you've got to understand the whole basics of the foundation of research. And you're just searching, and you're doing whatever anybody searched before and found. You are doing a research on that. And what you have to do is can't be so narrow-minded. You have to go in, and it becomes like a tree. If you search one word, let's say you want to search Republican or Republic. Now you go and find out that there, in the definition, there is a word called Commonwealth. Now you have to go and say, well, what is a Commonwealth? Now you go and read what a Commonwealth is. And then it leads you to another word that appears in the definition. And now you got to lock onto that word. And it sort of branches out that you've got a huge oak tree where you had a spindly little stump before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what a real researcher does. He not only researches to prove his case, but he researches to prove it's not. And if you mm-hmm. fail to prove and look or research that it is not, you're not a researcher.
Yeah, well, you have to go in, I would assume, with as objective a mind as possible and be willing to take the information where it goes.
Yes, exactly.
I think a lot of us are guilty of wanting to only look for that which substantiates what we believe.
Right. And that's why a true researcher doesn't do that.
Right.
He goes in with the attitude, let's find out where I am wrong.
Okay.
And that's the basics, because that saved me personally many times in the laboratory, but two times it didn't, and it wasn't my fault. But I had two laboratory explosions in my lifetime, and both times it put me in the hospital. But it was because that even when the PhDs who helped design this particular test that I was doing could not even duplicate what I did to get the explosion. And so that's why whenever I had something to do, and this is all in new territory when you do a research like this, you have to cover all bases. And in fact, when I got on the safety committee, someone wanted to do an experiment, and we would be called in to look at what the experiment is going to be. And then he says, okay, if this happens, how are you prepared? And the guy would look at you, well, you didn't research it far enough to find out what would happen if it did happen. And what is the antidote that you got to have? So this is when you go in to do the legal research. You've got to say, okay, why did they do it this way? Why are they using the particular terms that they are? And now let's see if I am wrong in my assumptions that they're wrong. Making sense? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't want to lose you.
Oh, no.
So that's why when you're doing research into statutes, look at the statutes, and then what you have to do, and this is where the ATG press is. I've already gone through the session laws now, like in when we did the archives in Raleigh, and we had to go down and find out what happened during this country during 1933 in that era when the war powers came in and Roosevelt. And we weren't particularly looking at Roosevelt, but we were looking in a particular state and the governors in the state. And you start looking at, okay, first we went in and we pulled all of the papers, the personal papers of the governor, and we sat down for hours and looked at it and read it. And what struck our mind, we marked, and you put a little tag on it. And the archivist then takes all the stuff back, and tags that he sees on there is what he knows he has to copy. Then he copies it. Then you go up and you tell him you want it certified. Now you go back down to your desk and you sit there, and when you have his copy, because you don't read the whole thing, you're skimming. And now you read the copy. This ain't no good. I don't know why I got that. But you got it. You know, it has to be done. And then another one would come up, oh, this is great. Oh, well, we got to go to the session laws now. Now you got to go into the session laws, and you start reading the session laws for that particular period of time. And out of the whole book, you might find five pages that you want. All right, you're reading like a 400-page book in their session laws, and you only get five pages out. Now you take the five pages, and you make copies, and you sit down, and you read it, and you understand what you're reading. It's just anybody can read words, but do you understand what they're saying in legal terms, in legalese, not in standard everyday talking on the street language? So then, once you get the session laws, then you find out, okay, they had the first reading in the statute, the first reading before, three readings to become a statute in North Carolina. And it can't be all in the same day. So now you go and you find the book on the next day, and you read that, and you see, did they change any wording in here? Oh, yeah, they changed five words in here. And you just keep doing this, and so if anybody goes to the ATG press and they have questions, they don't have to go to the library and sit through session laws and read the Federal Register and read the statutes and the regulations. It's all been done for you on ATG press.
Going back to the two countries.
Right.
What is...
Well, America, like you were saying, it's very hard to find anything on the term America or the word America, but you find a lot of it on the United States. But like I said, I have some old maps that we have, and where it lists today, it shows you the country. It says United States. It didn't say that. It said America. And we have letters from people in Europe to the people over here in the 1700s and late 1700s that refer to America, not the United States. We are coming to America. There is documentation with consulates from Spain, from France, from Portugal, speaking of America, not United States. So the landmass is a country called the United States. America,
right.
Not the United States.
Now,
the United States is a place in America. When they say United States of America, people have no concept because they forget grammar, and they don't know words. And if you look at the word of, it means belonging to, emanating from. It's a derivative of the word from. Are you not of your mother and father? Well, that means you came from your mother and father. You were produced from your mother and father. Okay? So when you look at the United States of America, it says the United States belonging to America. What's America? It's a country. What's the United States then? It's a place within the country.
Okay.
It's within America.
Was this set out right from the very beginning, since 1776?
Nope.
All right. Was this a 14th Amendment aftermath?
Excuse me.
Was that a 14th Amendment aftermath?
No. They were called colonies. They weren't called states.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And they were colonies which were actually plantations. And you don't look at plantation as a farm. It's a corporation.
Okay.
All right. And if you read John Burke's treatise on, Reconciliation of the Colonies by Burke, it explains that all of the colonies, it says in the preface, the speech on conciliation with the colonies delivered 150 years ago is read today in American schools, not United States schools, with the interest which attaches to a current day topic. All right, this is just the... but it's Edmund, EDMUNDBURKE.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in Dublin, Ireland in 1729. All right. And they talk about the English Constitution and the government. And it says they were familiar with that in the United States. And he's talking about the British Constitution and the United States Constitution. Didn't say American Constitution. And it didn't say England. England is a country. British is in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep going on with the colonies and the consolidation and everything. And they talk about the plantation. I don't have the particular thing in front of me. But the book is called Burke on Conciliation with the Colonies. And it was March 22nd, 1775.
So,
and they were doing the conciliation because England still owned all the colonies, and the colonies were fighting him, and they broke away, supposedly broke away, but they didn't really break away because they were still corporations of the crown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why I always felt that, you know, after a while, Great Britain or England might not have been all that concerned about shedding any more blood.
No.
For the purpose of putting down a rebellion when they said, look, this is a business enterprise and they're still hooked into us whether they like it or not.
That's right.
So let's just, you know, corporatize it and hit them where it hurts, and that's in the pocket.
Well, let me put it this way. Here's a good analogy, as best I can, with government and corporation. Let's say we all work for GM.
We might. Okay.
And GM has got five divisions, right?
Okay.
Cadillac, Buick, Oldsmobile, Pontiac. Yeah, with that. So each one of those divisions can run its own business. They can do their own advertising. They can do this. But sitting in the background is a parent corporation, GM, saying, you can't do that. Or, yeah, go ahead and do it. Well, let's look at this and let's say that we're all part and parcel of GM. Equate that to the United States, to America, to British colonies, right? And we all decided that, hey, we don't like the way GM's operating. We're going to form our own corporation or our own divisions, and we're going to take it over. Okay, that is the scenario that was at that time. Now, what right do you have to violate a contract? Doesn't the Constitution that they wrote up saying in Article 110(1) that no state will obligate a contract? You can't? Or can you come in as an interloper, a third party, into a contract that your mother and father has with someone else and control it? No, you can't. That's international law. That's, you know, and this is what was happening here, that the British corporation, GM, owning all the divisions, the 13 colonies, which is the five divisions of GM, and now once you can get this in your mind, you can now start to appreciate that the whole deal is nothing but corporate law. It's all corporations.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with free land and free this and free people and all that. If you work for GM, you have to follow GM procedures. If I'm walking off the street and walk into GM, I don't have to follow the procedures that the employees do. But if I stay there long enough, I sure do. And that's the same thing as why they said in some of the cases in North Carolina that if you don't want to stay in this colony, you must depart out of it. Okay, and then when I wrote in the New History of America, okay, the Lord says, depart out of it. Don't take anything in it. But you can still stay on the land because it's the Lord's land anyway to begin with, and no man shall own it. Well, then what right does, quote, the state of North Carolina have to say to the people, depart out of it and, you know, be gone because you don't want to join our corporation?
But you're never really allowed to do that.
That's right. That's right, yeah. See, this is where it gets a little the gray area, hard to discern between corporation and government. Government operates as a corporation, but government is a little bit different than a corporation. I mean, in the way they can operate. GM can't assume that the person on the street, they own them. But in government, they can assume that they own everybody that comes into their territory.
All right. And these days, what would justify that? I mean,
well, the fact in a lot of the searches that I've done, the mere presence of being in a state or going by, let's say you're in Florida and you travel up all the way up to North Carolina here to visit me. Okay. Every state that you go through, it's assumed that you will abide by their laws.
Okay.
All right. The same as the people that live there. Well, that's the assumption that they put upon every living man and woman, is that you're here, we own you.
Okay.
That's the bottom line. I mean, that's reality.
So, in other words, it doesn't matter necessarily that you have residency somewhere or a driver's license from a certain state.
Right, yeah, because when you drive through, see, you're an alien and you're non-resident, and you can find that in every state constitution and every state insurance law, is that when you drive through every state, the Secretary of State is your proxy for anything that happens in motor vehicle laws, should you have an accident and whatever, but they are your mouthpiece, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. So the old idea about departing from the estate, the plantation,
right,
which you'd love to do and say, good, then I don't have to pay state income tax, blah, blah, blah,
right,
that wasn't going to happen.
No.
No.
No, because the only way, you know, and it's hard because, all right, I'll depart out of the state of, or this state, and I am going to stay in North Carolina. I didn't put state of. I didn't put anything other than North Carolina, a geographical area called North Carolina. And but that's a hard pill to swallow for everybody to understand, and enough people can't get behind that to tell them, the state of, that I'm not a resident in your state. Now, if you look at the resident, and this is, I put in the book, Which One Are You? And it goes in and explaining what a resident is, and a resident means that you are part and parcel of the body politic and have joined such corporation, whether you know it or not, by the mere fact of claiming that this is your state, and so on and so forth. All terms that are legal in nature and not words of common, just, you know, you can say whatever you want in words on the street, and it isn't going to affect you legally. But if you use those words as a term, then it does affect you. It's convoluted. It sounds convoluted, but it's not really. It's a way that they design this country, these laws, so that the average man on the street has no clue that when he opens his mouth and puts foot in it, when he's talking to any government people, he's talking legal terms. He thinks he's talking words, but it's a legal term that they know and are using against them. The whole term, you open your mouth and you convict yourself. Sure, because you're talking words. You're not thinking terms. You're not thinking legalese. And that's just the sad fact that is how the Bar Association, the lawyers, were given control of the country to write all the laws and to do everything. Because take a look at the original founders. 55 of those people were lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And they all came from the British Crown.
Mm-hmm.
They all came from the Crown Temple. Well, naturally, if you go in and look on the history of the American Bar, which I put on the ATE Press, I took the excerpts from a large volume of the history of the American Bar by Charles Warren. Impeccable author, well-known. Can't dispute anything he says. But the lawyers back here in this country were frowned upon. Virginia even made it a hanging offense if you practice law. And right before the, I guess about 1774, the lawyers got enough control that they were starting to overrun the legal system as it stood, so that they could be put in place when the revolution took place, so that after it, they had complete control for the crown to write the laws as they saw. And that's what happened. So this is just a little bit going way back in history that people don't look at. They just only want to go back to the 30s or to the 40s when the income tax started. No, you got to go all the way back to find out what happened as to how the whole thing, piece by piece by piece, came into being. And this is where a real researcher does. You know, and it's only that I was gifted as with being taught by the best PhDs in research when I started into this stuff when I first got out of school. And yeah, I didn't care about history in school, and I didn't care about a lot of stuff. I said, what's that got to do with
anything
with today, you know? And it's got everything to do, because if you don't know the foundation of where things started and how they started, you're lost.
Well,
you look at what's going on today. It's, how can they tax me on this? How can they tax me on that? And what right do they have to tell me about seatbelt laws and what to wear and what not to wear and so on and so forth? But you've got to go back and look at it. Because here in North Carolina, when the seatbelt law and most other states, they said, okay, this, you can't get a ticket for a seatbelt law. You had to be stopped for some other violation, and if we happen to see you don't have a seatbelt, then we can give you a ticket. Right now in North Carolina, until the 21st of this month. They're going after all the pickups. And it was on TV last night, and they showed this road stop. And out of 3 hours, they ticketed 55 pickup drivers that didn't have their seat belts. Now, after this, from the 22nd on, it's click it or ticket in mm-hmm. North Carolina.
Yep.
And they can stop anybody and give you a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt. They don't have to do anything else. Well, when it first started, oh, no, that'll never happen. Well, mm-hmm. Little by little, they added it on, and now it's $100.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's $100 for all those people that got stopped just yesterday. They gave the figure how many tickets they gave. I think it was 55 in 4 hours.
Well, I know.
55 times 100, it's $5,500.
And I listen to this now because, it's interesting that North Carolina down here in Florida would be going through the exact same promotion campaign.
Yeah.
Which makes you wonder where it really comes down from.
It comes from the federal because
right.
That's what federal is doing. It's telling
right.
the people, since the 1966 Traffic Safety Act was passed, that is the criteria, which is under federal control, so every state has to abide by the 1966 Highway Traffic Safety Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go and you start looking, well, why is this, why is that? Well, gee, your driver's license, you have to, before you register your car, you got to get insurance on it, right? Well, once you get insurance on it, that's the key, because now you're an international maritime contract. And because you're an international maritime contract, you have to register the car or truck or, you know, whatever, even for your private use. And because you're a person now, you're not a man or a woman, all statutes are written in the term of person, which is the artificial character. So now, because you had to get insurance, you were forced to get it, you know, and it's maritime. And then when you register it, you automatically are in business because the maritime contract put you in business.
Yep.
And you say, well, wait a minute. Well, aren't you a resident of Florida? Yeah. Well, okay. If I'm there, I would say, where's your contract with Florida? Are a residency. Residency means a contract.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not privy to a contract, you're non-resident
mm-hmm.
in that contract. Which means that, okay, if I'm non-resident, then none of the statutes written for the contract apply.
And yet we spoke before, minutes before, about the fact that by your mere presence in the state.
That's right. And that's why you have to argue and bring up the correct arguments. But the problem is there's so few of us that it doesn't amount to anything. There has to be millions upon millions of people educated enough to go back into it and say, what right do you have to control us? We don't need government.
But yet, you can still be... Even though you're in these states, you're still in, you know,
that's right.
you're still in the federal...
Yeah, the federal realm. That's
right.
That's the presumption that they operate on. They operate on the presumption that everybody's a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And that's why everything is in capital letters, because they differentiate the human physical being from the artificial being by the capital letters of their name. And that's designed into the system. Like a paper corporation, all have to have capital letters. In fact, Georgia, in their statutes, comes right out and says that all corporations must be identified by capitalization. Yes, it does. I had a fellow, Don Wagers, from down there in Georgia, did some research for me, and he found it down in Georgia. And he sent it up to me. And I says, okay, that solidifies that. So therefore, all corporations must be in capital A's, capital words, capital letters. GMC, RCA, Food Lion, it's all capital letters. So therefore, that means they're artificial, but they're paper artificial. They're on paper. They're a group of people that got together, created a corporation, registered it in the state, and they're all capitalized. Now, each man, then, if he wants to become part of the corporation, he joins it, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you join a state? Oh, you go down and you register to vote. Right?
Okay.
So therefore, that takes the presumption away. And now it's a fact of law that you are a resident in the state of so-and-so, Florida, and therefore all statutes, that makes you a person, therefore all statutes are directed toward persons which are artificial characters. So now you gave up your man status, your man character, not status. Status is a legal term.
Right.
Character is not. And you gave up that, and you are part and parcel a person, and all statutes are written for persons, and therefore persons are the subject of the statute. And you're cooked meat. You can't go in and argue that I'm a man, because if you've got all these latches that they pull in place upon you, it's hard to beat. Very hard to beat.
Now we could move ahead with the the idea of the United States as the framers knew it.
They knew it, sure. Because, they all had property in England. They were all millionaires, according, to today's standards. And the Crown said, hey, look, guys, we got the Navy. We can put a blockade against America, and you ain't going to get squat. And therefore, we will also take all your property and confiscate it under the law of Mortmain. You can't give it to anybody. That's where mortgage came from, the law of Mortmain.
Okay.
And in case people wonder what Mortmain is, in the old days in England, when people died, they would give their property to the church. So the crown couldn't control the churches at that point in time, anyway. And the king saw all his land being donated to the church, right? And to stop it, he wrote the Law of Mortmain, which means you could no longer donate your land to the church when you died. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that's where Mortmain comes in. And if people want to research Mortmain, then go on the internet probably and type in Mortmain and see what they come up with.
Well, now mortgage is used to mean probably you're paying until you're dead.
That's right. Yeah.
So, but when the Constitution was drafted, and the Bill of Rights in particular, it's your belief, not belief, I mean, if you've got the goods on it, we'll just call it what you found out, is that they didn't apply to you and me.
Right.
Why did it apply just to those who hang out in the district?
Because, remember, the United States consisted of Congress assembled, which was 75 people. That was it. That was we the people. That's the that's why the word people was capitalized, and it's the third word in a sentence of we the people. And that's why Patrick Henry said, who gave them the right to say, we the people?
All right, so in other words, that isn't some kind of archaic form of grammatic rules, as most of us, and I in particular, have always believed.
Yeah, that's what they did. See, they had to couch it in words that the common people then is the same as the common people today.
Mm-hmm.
Have no clue. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy to put off over people today the same way as they did back then, because the people in Philadelphia, when they...
Okay, for all those who are listening, we were doing this in a pre-record and a dropout, so we just went ahead and patched that. And we'll continue with the discussion about the use of the capital P for people and Patrick Henry's resistance to that.
Well, what they did was... whenever you use a capital letter in a sentence and it's not the first word of the sentence. You're talking about a specific thing or person or place or whatever. There can be many red cars out in the parking lot, and if I tell you to go get a red car, well, you can go get any red car. But if we're talking before that, and I'm saying, well, Jesus, a Ford out there, it's a red car that's mine, and here's the keys, and maybe I'll ask you to go get it for me sometime. And then I say or write, where it's emphasized, next time I see it, oh, go get that red car. And I capitalize red. That means it's red, but it's a particular red car that you already know what that is. Therefore, you go out and you get the Ford, red Ford, and you bring it back to me. That's how you know that is a specific Ford red car. Specific red car, mm-hmm. which is a Ford. And that's what they did when they wrote people, because they wanted to be specifically sure that it meant them, the 75 people that signed the Constitution, and not everyday common man on the street, which then they would have taken the capital P out and replaced it with a small p, meaning everybody.
Yeah, but Pat, you know, Patrick Henry knew this, and yet he still signed on?
Yeah.
All right, what do we think about Patrick Henry?
Patrick Henry was a lawyer.
Above all other things, huh?
Right.
So, in other words, those characters...
In other words, he was telling people, hey, you're getting screwed, but I'm a lawyer, and I have first allegiance to the crown, to the court, and I'm telling you people, but this is the way it's going down, but I have to sign off on it.
So the founding fathers, the original politicians down there, were basically securing their own butts.
Exactly.
So then what in the heck difference was it really than being... We never did get rid of the king.
No, that's what I say. That's what I wrote in the book. We never... And that's why Montgomery said, we never got rid, we never won the war. And like Montgomery pointed out, if you win a war, like we did in World War II, and MacArthur went over, and on the battleship, they signed the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And he dictated all the parameters, and Japan couldn't have armed services. They had to give up their guns and all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how come during the Revolutionary War when this happened and we won, why did the king dictate
mm-hmm.
the Treaty of Peace? Why did
mm-hmm.
they keep the armed soldiers on this land all the way up to 1812 if they won the war in 1776?
Well, let me ask you: did those troops hang around long enough for the battle of for the War of 1812?
Yeah.
they were, and then this must mean from the time in between. I mean, you're not going to have the same soldiers in the outfit. That's too many years.
They're constantly changing, just like we changed over in Vietnam or Korea. Look how long it's been since what 1953.
Okay.
And the soldiers are constantly being changed on the guard over there for the demilitarized zone, the DMZ.
All right, so we have...
38th parallel or something like that.
So we have American citizens watching soldiers disembark from the ship to be stationed in their country.
Yeah, same thing.
So what was, in a nutshell, what was the whole idea of the War of 1812?
To start another war... Which, when you have an international law, when you have a treaty between two countries, and one of those countries starts a war all over again, it negates the treaty. Nothing is in the treaty. That's why they had the 1792 treaty in the interim to make sure that things were going back in the 1783 treaty that the king couldn't really sign off on. And then, after the 1812 war, when they destroyed a lot of the documents in Washington, what cropped up next was the secret treaty of Verona in 1822.
And you know about that.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was, what, over there?
Yep.
The signatories said, we're not going to have this Republican rebellion spirit on this side of the pond.
Right.
And the Vatican was involved in that?
Yes, oh yes.
All right. So that was it then, huh?
Yeah.
They had to vacate the old treaty, begin a new one.
to vacate the old treaty, and then when they vacate the old treaty, guess what it reverts back to? The original treaty before that. Now, how many people know what the original treaty was?
What was it?
The Virginia Charter of 1602.
That's the first, that's it, that's the first.
Uh-huh, and that meant that all the colonies were back under the control of the crown. Now the state, they're called states now, but they're under control of the crown, and that's it. Bottom line.
Now,
see, now if you don't know this, this and how to research going all the way back and do this, you don't have the foundation to where you're operating today. And you wonder, why is this happening?
Sure.
Why are we being controlled? Why are we losing all our freedoms? It's a slow process because the international people look hundreds of years down the road, where the American people look past the end of their nose, well, next week we're going to do this. I don't know what we're doing next month.
And not to go, this is like another like whole show. I mean, it's just amazing. But we always felt that the falling out that England had with the Vatican over Henry VIII really wasn't a falling away from the church. And so, can we also assume, let me just ask you, do you believe that perhaps by the time of the, 18th century into the early 19th century, that the Vatican had been using England, perhaps as one of its agents over here?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course...
And the same as France and the same as Spain, because they all were all controlled by the Vatican.
Right.
I mean, the Jesuits was hell-bent, and their main goal was to, anywhere a republic was started, they had to go in and destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
Which they did. They went to Brazil. They went to Argentina. Way back before this country was formed into what it is, to stop them from being a republic.
You
can find this in documented form in The Rockefeller and Their Gold Corner by Emmanuel Josephson. Was printed in 1946.
Okay. Hey.
Yeah, it's really convoluted, and the poor American people are out there saying, "Well, how can they do this? How can they do that?" Well, gee, just go back and look at contract international law, and you got it.
Well, in the time that we have left, this is the reason for this last show. Well, I mean, the reason we wanted to discuss about this, because it would be the last show, and that is folks wanted to know how in the world did this ever happen, and that's what we're talking about today.
Right.
And now we're so far removed from all this layers, you know, of subterfuge and such, that it's, I mean, I can understand myself when some people go, you know what, I don't want to know about this, let me put my head back in the ground and what difference is it going to make in my life? And, I'm not even going to argue that with them.
Because that's true. I mean, that's the mentality, because, like, just this morning on air, talking about the driver's license and about those people in Baltimore that got stopped for asking directions and thrown in jail.
That'll teach you.
You know, I mean, you can fight it. Like, okay, my daughter-in-law got a ticket through the mail from Virginia, I think it was Washington, D.C., on these cameras, speed cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she wasn't there. She wasn't driving the car. She loaned her car, right? So she got the ticket, and it was $100, and she could pay it, and there's no fine. I mean, there's no points on her driver's license or nothing like this, right? And it showed the picture of the car. You couldn't see who was in it, and she paid it, okay? And I just happened to notice when I got the mail for her the other day that there was a notice in there as a failure to pay, but she had paid it. They crossed in the mail, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, why would I go out and get $400 for a lawyer to fight it, $100? I'm going to be out $300. I don't have it.
Yeah.
So I pay it.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody, you know, does. And that's how they make their money.
Well, it gets one step weirder, too, and I'm sure you're aware of what took place up in Connecticut when the fine print told a car rental lessor that he had GPS in the vehicle, and if he went over the speed limit, he would be duly ticketed. And so what he found out is he got like two or three.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And but the interesting thing was it wasn't a law enforcement agency that collected it. It was a private company.
Yeah.
That's even more scary, I think.
Right.
So, and then let's go into this last thing if we could. A lot of people argue about this. We've touched upon it, but if we could one more time, in the time that we have, uh-huh. the reality of what law the Kerns are under when we go into a court. We talk a lot about common law, civil law, admiralty, maritime, UCC.
Uh-huh.
You want to just kind of segment that out so it's clear to folks?
Well, the bottom line is it's contract law. It's under maritime in an admiralty court. They merged admiralty, equity, got rid of common law, and I have some court cases that I just found, that defines the fact that we don't have no more common law. I don't have them. They're so new to me that I can't even give you the cite,
mm-hmm.
and I've got to read them some more to digest it. You know, I read a case five times, and I read the case backwards. Many people don't understand. Read the case backwards.
I do, because what happens is you start to drift. Your eyes go across the words after so many times, right?
Yeah. But what you want to do is you want to see what the court's determination was in the very beginning. Was the guy guilty? Was the guy not guilty? And why?
Okay.
In the conclusion, all right? Now you go and you start reading from the front down, and now you know the guy lost, all right? Why did he lose? If you're reading it down from the top down, and by the time you get to the bottom, you forgot what you read,
right.
Especially in a long case,
mm-hmm.
and you read what the conclusion is, and now, why did he lose, you know? Because you've got this presumption in your mind,
mm-hmm.
when you're reading the case. All right, you're looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
You can't look for anything. You've got to read the conclusion first and the decision, then go back and then you start reading, and then you'll hit on certain key words that was in the conclusion. You'll say, aha, I can now see why he lost,
mm-hmm.
or I can see why he won. But equity, okay, they're all there for the court to use how it wants to use it.
Okay.
Now let's take contract law. I go down to buy a thing from Sears and I take it back because it don't work and there's a dispute. So we go in. Now, what court are we in? Okay, we're in the basic admiralty court, but we're going to go by contract. And now we're going by contract law. That's why Repi on contracts and others are so well published.
But is contract only, does it only exist under admiralty?
Most of the time, yes. There are some cases where it's not.
Okay.
Now, contract of insurance, that's admiralty. Straight out, boom, admiralty.
Okay.
Contract of motor vehicles, straight out admiralty. You'll find it in Benedict on admiralty in the 7th edition. That's the best one that I like to use.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the original one, but people can't get that. But anything after the 7th edition, they get so convoluted and everything that you get lost.
Okay.
All right. But so I have a dispute with my... hurricane went through and blew my roof off. So I go to the insurance company and say, well, I want to give you half of it. Well, wait a minute. No, this is a dispute. Now it's a contract dispute. But it's in admiralty because it's a maritime claim.
What makes it a maritime claim?
Insurance.
Okay.
DeLovo versus Boyd. Way back in U.S. Steamship versus United New Jersey Steamship Navigation.
Yeah, but if this isn't happening over water, so how come if it's terrestrial, it's maritime?
It don't matter, because what they did in 1857 is they moved admiralty inland no matter what.
Okay, now is admiralty and maritime synonymous?
No. There is a little difference. And when I read the difference on that maritime, the only way I found it was in on the Benedict on Admiralty in the 1850 edition. which is the very first edition that I got, that most all judges in the know have this bench book in their chambers. They don't go outside their chambers. Now, let me see. It says, the maritime does not depend on a particular court. Civil law is admiralty, not common law. This is right out of the American Admiralty is jurisdiction and practice.
It's civil, not common law.
Yes, it says in Section 5 on page 3 about the admiralty laws indebted for many of its characteristics to the circumstances of the countries in which it was at first administered. It says, in England, where the common law was the law of the land, the civil law was held to be the law of the admiralty, and of course of proceedings in admiralty closely resembled the civil law practice. So therefore, when you talk about civil rights, you're talking about admiralty rights.
Okay.
There's five ways of admiralty. And the Constitution of the United States grants to the federal government judicial power over all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. This is the whole of the grant of that branch of judicial power, and brief and simple as it is, upon the true construction depends the whole of the American admiralty jurisdiction. It has received five different constructions, and then they list all five.
Can you give us headings? What the five are?
Well, let me see. That this Constitution grants only those few cases in which the English High Court of Admiralty was permitted to take cognizance of time of the American Revolution. The actual jurisdiction of the state courts of Admiralty, which were existence in the adoption of the Constitution of the United States, was alone embraced in the grant. The words Admiralty and Maritime relate simply to subject matter and were used in that general sense were employed embraces all the cases relating to ships and shipping, which under the maritime municipal regulations of each nation, which arise under the general maritime law, in endeavoring to ascertain which of these constructions ought to prevail, I shall first in the place recur to some general principles, and then they go on to the general principles, and this book is about 800 and some odd pages thick, and it's the original admiralty practice in jurisdiction and forms in the United States in 1850.
Could you give us, in a sentence or so, what the distinction is between maritime and admiralty?
I mean, okay, I was just looking in here to give you the
okay.
The right maritime, not depend on particular court. They must use the English dictionary in all the laws in this country. This is 1850 now. Oh yeah, it's what it says. It says, still is not to be forgotten that our people were not homogeneous, but consisted of persons from all civilized nations, English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, Dutch, Swedes, and French. By some conquest, and some by immigration, were mixed and united to make the American nation. Got that?
Mm-hmm.
Say United States, the American nation.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And that's where it then says, it is to the English law and to the English dictionaries that we must resort for the meaning of those terms.
All right.
But it by no means follows that we must look to the same source of the structure and jurisdiction for our national courts or for the rules of decision which they are to follow. The force of the common language, even added to that of our historical connection, was altogether too feeble properly to give our new-made and original political institutions any transatlantic odor, much less to characterize them by strong English analogies. Maritime, I'm trying to find here. The five ways of admiralty is administered. Transactions embraced in maritime conduct may only be classified in a simple and intelligible order. Vessels, the only means by which navigation. Management of the vessel is entrusted to the leader, also, whether people know it or not, a car is a vessel, comes under international law.
Okay.
The common law, I'm trying to find. I have as many pages in here porcupined as I do pages.
Which means there's no sense to
me. Yeah, I'm trying to find all attorneys, conflict of interest, process of rem, who we are in admiralty, real party of interest. Now, in the warring thing, both parties are the actors. Libelant is some called the promovent, actor, and plaintiff. Now, actor is a person. That's his character that he operates in.
Mm-hmm.
All process in Admiralty, all IRS processes in Admiralty, his liens and stuff, they're all Admiralty.
Okay.
Admiralty applied to statute. Darn. Rule 44, Admiralty. Rule 53. Rule in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rules 636 and 28 is all Admiralty rules. Rule 55 to 58 is Admiralty. And people don't understand that, but that is Admiralty. There was a difference in here, darn it. I wish I could find
it. Well, I tell you what, you can email it to me because obviously...
Yeah. I'll email
yeah.
that to you.
And then by the time the show airs, I cannot put that in the somewhere in the show,
uh-huh.
that answer. So, I mean, the good thing about doing a recording is the fact that we can amend it.
Okay, what is maritime? Maritime law regulates and enforces all maritime contracts. It does not take cognizance of agreements not in themselves maritime, although they may be preliminary to maritime contracts. So, too, the building of a ship is a maritime service, and the building contract is one with your cognizance of Admiralty. But a mere undertaking to make a building contract for a ship or to procure a person to build a ship is not within the jurisdiction of Admiralty, but maritime.
Okay.
It is not a maritime contract. It is not subject to regulation of the maritime law. The distinction in many cases will undoubtedly seem shadowy and unreal. Still, in a large class of cases, it will be readily perceived, and it's important, fully appreciated. And there's more to it,
right.
But that's one part of it.
All right, we're running over, and I'm going to let that happen. But because we are, I'm just giving you a heads up. All right, how does UCC fit in all this?
UCC is contract law. You have to have a contract with a particular party in order to go into a court with them. Now, in this Admiralty, I'll read you.
Okay.
The Sixth Amendment is expressly limited to criminal prosecutions for crimes committed in some states or districts of the United States. The Seventh Amendment is limited to suits at common law, which does not include either suits of equity or of Admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. So, that means okay. that if you go in under the Seventh Amendment and it comes right out and says so, the Seventh Amendment is common law and has no business in an Admiralty court. Now, guess why? The court says you can't bring in the Seventh Amendment because it's $20 in common law suit, silver. There is no silver.
So in other words, since you don't have the means of transaction, you can't do it.
That's right.
Now, you could really get that, couldn't you?
Well, in the phrase suits of common law in the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution has also been made the foundation of the objection to the Admiralty jurisdiction in all these cases, which in England, at the time of the Revolution, could not be tried in the court of Admiralty, but it must be brought in the courts of common law, an objection which seems to have been first raised by the late Judge Baldwin in the case of Baines versus the schooner James and Catherine. All right, now remember, this was written in 1850. 1857... they bought Admiralty inland, and no matter what contract you had, came under maritime jurisdiction. Therefore, Admiralty Court. By cases in law was meant the cases which legal rights and duties and offenses are to be ascertained in courts of law. By cases in equity, they are meant in cases which equitable rights and duties are to be ascertained in courts of equitable jurisdiction and proceeding. And by Admiralty and maritime is meant which maritime rights, duties, and offenses became subject to the judicial cognizance in courts of Admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. What is IRS? What is any revenue? Maritime. Admiralty. Jurisdiction.
Now, amongst these three, one is not, shall we say, more powerful or ubiquitous than the others, or is there?
No, no.
Okay.
No, it has to be a maritime contract, in other words, for an Admiralty court to sit, or the court to sit mm-hmm. as Admiralty. The court can pick and choose what it wants, and that's what it usually does.
And what about capital offenses, like murder?
Capital offenses in the United States was never given the court the jurisdiction for capital offenses.
Okay.
What they do is they took it and applied it like a capital offense, like in the two cases that I had cited in my New History of America, United States versus one Chevy pickup and one was a Ford, in that they started the case in admiralty and slid over to the civil side, which then everything became civil, even though it was criminal prosecution.
Well, we see cases where you have a criminal trial, and then,
right,
like with OJ being high profile, then they go civil.
Yeah. But in this way, they can make the whole trial civil. In other words, they have to bring the civil rules of procedure, Title 28, in, and they don't bring in Title 18, the criminal procedures.
So they morph right during the trial?
Yeah.
Does anybody tell the defendant's lawyer?
The defendant's lawyer knows it.
But it's a game he plays, too.
Yes.
All right, is there a point where he calls him to the bench and says, all right, we're doing it this way from here on in? Or in his chambers or something?
Well, let's put it this way. If you and I are mechanics, and we happen to go and be working on a car or something like that, we know exactly what we're supposed to do, huh?
Mm-hmm.
To get that car back, to run it.
Okay.
The owner doesn't know. Well, the same way in court.
Okay.
The owner doesn't know, but you and all your bar members know the procedures that has to take place during that trial.
Mm-hmm. Another dirty little secret on us, huh?
Yes. Yes.
All right. I'm going to bring it to a halt there. And, there's not enough I can say by way of thank you for coming on.
Okay.
I hope you appreciate it. I guess you indicated that you did, and I did right from the outset, and so did a whole lot of listeners. And
yeah, I think the last time I was on radio, a live radio show that I was happened to be, was back in about 1992, 93. This is the last time I was on a radio show.
Well, welcome back.
Okay.
Check out Against the Grain Press. That's ATGPress.com. Everything you want to know is there, and like Iman said, will you please go there and listen, it's there for you at your leisure. Go read it, go find it out, and you'll have a better understanding of it yourself. Once again, Iman, thanks very much. I'll talk to you down the road somewhere.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time and your study.
All right.
You got one. Bye.
Bye-bye.